Okay, welcome back after a week off. After breaking a few for Shavuos, we're going to pick up on our regularly scheduled topic, which has been for the past few months, the vessels of the Mishkan and Beis HaMikdash, which we're about to conclude, actually, after, I don't know, 2-3 months of discussing them. What's left for us to discuss this week, and I think in one more week we'll discuss one more vessel next week, and then we'll move on into other topics. But this week I want to discuss the Mizbeach HaChitzon, the outer altar. Then the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, also, we discussed way back when, there's three different areas. There is the Holy of Holies inside the building, the back chamber. There is the Holy, which is, that's inside the building, but in the front. And then there was the outer courtyard. Everything we discussed until now has been inside the building. We discussed the Ark, we discussed the incense altar, we discussed the table for the showbread, we discussed the menorah. Those are all inside the building. Now we're moving out to the courtyard. And in the courtyard is where they had the outer altar. Let's get our pictures back so we can get the context again. If I can find the picture. There we go. Here's a picture of the Mishkan. And until now we've discussed the inside of the Mishkan building itself. And now we're discussing the altar, which is out in the courtyard. This altar, the Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem had the same setup. It was on a much larger scale, but it was the same setup. It was the three different areas, the outer courtyard, the building itself, and the inner chamber of the Holy of Holies also existed in the Beis HaMikdash itself. The altar in both places was out in the courtyard. This is the altar which they would offer the animal offerings upon, which really was the centerpiece of the Beis HaMikdash. That was the most common service done there, was the animal sacrifices. The concept of sacrifice itself requires its own class, which hopefully we'll get to, God willing, in a few weeks. But for now, we'll discuss the altar, not the sacrifices. We'll discuss the altar itself. The altar, just as an important note, the altar that was used in the Mishkan was different than the one used in the temple itself. The altar in the Mishkan was made out of copper. The one in the temple was made out of stone. So even though the vessels of the Mishkan, for the most part, were the same vessels used in the actual temple itself, the altar was different. The altar, they had a copper altar, which we'll discuss today in the Mishkan. In the temple, they had a stone altar. We did discuss the stone altar a few months back, because we discussed the command not to use an iron or sword to cut the stones of the altar. It's a prohibition in the Torah that when you're making the stone altar, it can't be hewn stone, it has to be whole stones. You're not allowed to cut it with metal, you're not allowed to use a sword or a knife to cut the stones. So we discussed that a few months back. But today we'll discuss the copper altar that was used in the Mishkan.
Was it solid copper?
It was plated. It was wood and plated with copper. Yeah, it was wood plated with copper. So, as we usually do, first we'll discuss just the specs of the altar, and then we'll discuss some of the symbolism. So let me try to get a better picture here, just for our, make it easier. There we go. Not a great picture, but it's a picture. So it'll help us. You can pass it around, you can look at it. But in general, the altar itself, the Torah tells us, was made out of wood. As the wood was called shittim wood, which we've seen before in the different vessels of the temple and of the Mishkan. It was a form of cedar wood. That's what it was made out of. It was plated in copper on all of the exposed surfaces. So when you looked at it, all you see was copper. It was all copper plated. But beneath the copper was the shittim wood. The middle of the altar was hollow. They would take it apart. They would carry it. They traveled it. When they camped, they would fill it up with dirt in the middle. But it was actually a hollow chamber in the middle of the altar. There's a dispute if there's actually a top surface that was put onto the altar or not. Some say they offered the sacrifices right on the dirt, which they filled up in the middle. And some say they actually created a floor on the top upon which they offered the sacrifices. But it was definitely hollow in the middle, that's for sure. The dimensions as listed in the Torah for this altar, the Torah says, it's chapter 27 of the book of Shmos, in the very beginning. It says it was 5 amos long. Again, an amma we usually estimate to be approximately 2 feet. So let's call it 10 feet long, 5 amos wide, 10 feet wide, it was square. And it was, the Torah says it should be 3 amos tall, which would be 6 feet. However, there's a dispute in the Gemara what it means it should be 3 amos tall. Some say, which seems to be the consensus halakhically, that it was actually 10 amos tall. It was much taller than 3 amos, so it was about 20 feet tall. The reason the Torah says three amos tall is it's actually counting not from the bottom, but counting from what's called the silve, which we'll discuss. There's a ring around the middle of the altar, and it was three amos above that ring. But the actual height, according to Maimonides, and it seems to be the mainstream conclusion, would be that it was 10 amos tall. That's how we assume. So it's actually a pretty tall vessel. It was about 20 feet high. But so 5 amos by 10 amos, then would be the final number, which we would call about 10 feet by 10 feet by 20 feet. That's how we view it. The different parts, the elements, where'd the picture go? Just a second. Stanley has it. Right. Can I borrow the picture for a second? So I'll point out a few things. We'll pass it back, yeah. The altar itself had four different parts to it. You had this bottom part, was a foundation called the Yesod, and that was actually a separate piece that was placed under it. There was the, this over here is called the Michbar. It was like a, kind of like a mesh, as a metal meshwork then around the altar. Above that, where you see these pictures, is called the Karkov, which was, this is kind of like a protruding ring going all around it. And the very top, these things sticking up, these are called the Karnos. These we translate as, I guess, horns, or these protrusions coming up, or the Karnos of the altar. So those are the four different features beyond the altar itself for these four different parts. The foundation, the Yesod, this meshwork belt going around it, this protrusion above that, and then the horns coming out to the corners. So now you can look again and see those four parts. Those are the four parts the Torah commands us to have on the altar. Let's discuss the details of those four parts. On that bottom foundation, the Yesod, was one amma off the ground, so let's call it 2 feet off the ground approximately, and also came out one amma. So it was about 2 feet coming out and 2 feet tall. That was all around the bottom of the altar. That was important in the temple service because they used to sprinkle, there's certain types of bloods that were sprinkled on the foundation of the altar. If you read through the Torah carefully, you'll see some bloods of offerings were sprinkled on the top, some are sprinkled on the bottom, and some are sprinkled on the foundation. So depending on which sacrifice you're offering, you would sprinkle the blood in a different place. Why that's true, we can discuss a different time, but each sacrifice had its own different laws of where to sprinkle the blood. In the actual altar in the temple, which we said was different than the altar in this picture, there was no foundation in the southeast of the altar, for a different reason. We'll discuss in the future. But in the Mishkan, the foundation went all around. In the temple itself, in the southeast of the altar, there was no foundation there. It was just the altar going straight down. Interesting why that is, but we'll leave that for another discussion. Above that, we had what was called the michbar, that meshwork going around. I wish we had a better picture. But you can all see, like right here, it looks like it's kind of like a netting. It was made out of copper, that part. It was like a copper netting. But it was a belt going all the way around the altar. That was called the michbar. It had four rings attached to it through which the poles went through. You can see the rings, the poles went through those rings. That's how they carried it through the desert. And the simple understanding of why they had this meshwork is for decoration. They wanted to make the vessels of the Mishkan look beautiful. These are God's holy vessels. This is how you serve God in the temple and in the Mishkan. So therefore, you want to make them look beautiful. So there was actually an artistic design which God commanded to be put upon these vessels. So one of these artistic designs was this meshwork. We'll discuss more what it might symbolize. But the simple understanding is that it was artistic, and it made it look beautiful. It was one amma tall. Again, that's about 2 feet tall. That's how tall it was. It was put right above the midpoint of the altar. The altar was ten amos tall, so this was actually stuck at the fifth amma. So this would go from the fifth to the sixth amma, you would have this meshwork. And it acted as a divider, meaning that some sacrifices, we said, you're supposed to sprinkle the blood above, and some you sprinkle the blood below, so this was the dividing line. So sacrifice supposed to sprinkle above would be above this michbar, above this meshwork, and the one supposed to sprinkle below is below the meshwork. The
sacrifice blood was below it also?
Yeah, it just depends on which sacrifice you're doing. So sometimes you sprinkle blood below, sometimes above. It depends. Just to make, I think what's bothering Judy in general, most sacrifices had two different elements to them. There was the burning of the meat of the animal, which is done on the top of the altar typically. But there's also the sprinkling of the blood. And the sprinkling of the blood was done on the sides of the altar. They would not sprinkle the blood on the top. They would sprinkle the blood onto the walls going around the altar. So sometimes the blood would be onto the foundation, sometimes below the meshwork, sometimes above the meshwork. But they had the Kohanim had different rules for each karban as to where they're supposed to sprinkle the blood. So Which gets confusing as you read through the book of Vayikra. You see all these different specifications of offerings, and it's very confusing. But each one had its own special rules of how to sprinkle the blood, and where to bring the meats, and which direction you should be standing when you soldered it. Everyone, very specific rules about each and every offering. Above that was what we called the karkov. Again, you had this designed protrusion above the meshwork. It's called the karkov in Hebrew. Chaf resh chaf bez. And that also, the simple understanding was, is there for decoration. As you can see in the picture, there's actually designs etched into it. The rabbis tell us it was there, had designs etched. You can look closer. It's hard to see. It's a small picture, a lot of people. But there are designs actually etched into this karkov, to this protrusion. And that was also meant to be for decoration, it seems. That was directly above the meshwork. And then on the very top, we discuss the karnos, these horns, coming out of the top corners of the altar. These horns are made out of the same wood as the altar itself, meaning it wasn't a separate piece that was attached to the altar. It was carved from the same board, which is used to make the wall of the altar. They would carve out of that same piece of wood these horns.
Integral to the part, in other words, with the horn left one solid.
Yeah, right. It's one solid piece, and the horns were carved out of it. So that's how they made the horns. The horns were hollow within, and the dimensions of the horns were one by one by one amma. So that gives us all the specifications of the altar itself. There was a ramp that they used to get up to the altar. If it's 20 feet tall, you can't just jump on. You have to have a ramp. So they had a ramp they built called the kevesh, which they used to get up onto the altar to bring the sacrifices. We did discuss a few months back how there was a Torah prohibition to use steps to get to the altar. You have to use a ramp. You're not allowed to use steps. So we discussed that a few months back. There has to be a ramp and not steps.
Was the ramp attached?
It was not attached. It was separate. They push it right up to the edge, but it was a separate ramp.
How did they transport that? That had to be a long ramp to get 6 feet high.
Yeah, it was about, I think, 30 amos long, which is about 60 feet.
You know?
Yeah, so I guess they just took it apart and carried it, I assume. I don't really know. They could disassemble it. So they had wagons they used in order to transport what they needed to transport. But it could be they took it apart as they traveled. I'm not sure.
Did they have animals?
They had animals, yeah.
So horses or
the oxen? The Levites were given, I think, oxen and wagons to transport the different heavy parts of the
Mishkan.
Yeah. But the vessels themselves, like the altar, was carried on their shoulders. The family of Kahas, who was responsible for carrying all the vessels, carried them on their shoulders. But the actual boards of the Mishkan building and all the different curtains, that were carried on wagons. I assume this was put on a wagon. I assume, because that's not one of the integral vessels of the Mishkan. But there were wagons they used, but the most important vessels were carried on their shoulders, not by wagons. So the Ark, the Menorah, those were all carried on their shoulders. So the Mizbeach, so that's the specification of the Mizbeach. Those are the details, technicalities. The Mizbeach, this is really the busiest part of the Mishkan. Most people who came, they were there to bring an animal offering. Animal offerings were offered on this Mizbeach, and flower offerings as well. Flower offerings were also offered on this Mizbeach. In the inner room of the temple, they had the incense altar. That was used for incense only, nothing else. It was used for incense. So this was where everything happened. All the magic happened here. That's where everything happened. It was on this altar. The purpose of the Beis HaMikdash, to a large degree, was the ability to bring karbanos, to bring offerings to God. That's one of the major purposes of building a temple. That's why we had it. So this is where it all happened, was on this Mizbeach. It primarily served for atonement. The rabbis tell us that the Hebrew word Mizbeach can be used as an acronym. The acronym stands for Mechila. You spell Mizbeach Mem, Zayin, Abez, Ches. So the Mem would stand for Mechila, which means pardon, forgiveness. The Zayin would stand for Zechus, for merit. The Bez for Bracha, for blessing. And the Ches for Chaim, for life. Because bringing sacrifice on the altar was to bring to us forgiveness, merit, blessing, and life. So the word itself is an acronym for those four different concepts of forgiveness, merit, blessing, and life. The Torah says that when God gives the command to build the altar, it says, Yasisa es ha-mizbeach, you should build the altar. It doesn't say build an altar, it says build the altar. So commentaries are bothered by, why are you talking about the altar? It's an altar. Why is it the altar? So one commentary, the Abarbanel, he says, because everybody was anticipating this command. The Jews at the time, they're eager to be able to have a central place to offer offerings to God. This was part of the tradition. We know that Adam brought offerings Noah brought offerings, the patriarchs brought offerings, everyone always brought offerings to guide carbonos, sacrifices throughout history.
Adam did too?
Adam did too. Yeah, the rabbis tell us, you don't see that in the Torah, the rabbis tell us Adam also brought offerings. So everyone brought offerings. This was such a central part of the service of God in those days. They're all anticipating, when can we have a central altar to bring sacrifices to God upon? So God said, the altar, which you've all been waiting for, which you've been anticipating all these years, it's time to build it. And they're very excited to build this altar. For us, again, sacrifices are kind of a far-off concept. But we have to understand, this is really an integral part of the service of God for thousands of years. And we have to be able to tap into what it really means. Again, in future weeks, hopefully we'll discuss that. But just to know that even though sacrifices are very foreign to us, there is a very deep meaning behind sacrifice, and that was really a central part of the service of God for many, many, many centuries, many millennia. So now I'd like to discuss some of the symbolism of the altar. We discussed all the details, what all these things symbolize. And as we always preface, you know, the symbolism which we give to it is not the only meaning behind it, it's not the only reason why we do why we have an altar to these specifications, but it is our job to figure out why these details matter. Why does God specify it in this way? These materials, this shape, why are all these things important? So let's try to take the details one by one, understand the importance of the details. So I'd like to start just discussing the material. The material it's made out of was shittim wood, this type of cedar wood, and copper, plated with copper. So the Kli Yakar, one of the great commentators in the Torah, he points out, based on the Midrash, based on what the rabbis tell us in the Midrash, that the word atzei shittim, shittim wood, it comes from the same root word as the word for shtus. Shtus. Shtus means foolishness. That's what someone's doing, shtus. You know, it's foolishness. You know, so why is it related to foolishness? Because when you bring a sacrifice for atonement on the altar, it's because the person has sinned. And the rabbis tell us that somebody who sins has done something very foolish. The Talmud has a quote. It says, "Ein adam chote, a person does not sin, except for the fact that a ruach shtus, a spirit of shtus, a foolishness, has entered into him. A little bout of craziness." So what does that mean? That means that, Sir Rabbi Noach Weinberg's Latzal, Avisha Torah, used to say, what does it mean? Because you got to be crazy to sin. That's what he said. Sinning, you got to be crazy if you sin. But what does it mean? It means that intellectually, going against God makes absolutely no sense. There is an all-powerful God, all-knowing, eternal, he created us, he keeps us alive, he knows what's good, he knows what's bad, he gave us everything we have. To go against his word is crazy. It's insane. Why in the world would we do that? It doesn't make sense intellectually. But we do it. Why? Because we're humans, and we're flawed, and we can rationalize, and we have Yetzer Hara, which drives us to the wrong thing. And through our free choice, and our lusts, and all the challenges we have as humans, so we do make mistakes, and we do sin at times. But if you step back and think about it purely through intellect, and remove your emotion, and remove your experiences from it, it doesn't really make sense that we do such things. You know, doing something bad, evil, sinful, it doesn't make sense. It's not intellectually, it's not rational. But yet we do it. So the rabbis say a person sins because they've gone crazy for a minute. You know, you're not using your mind. You're letting your heart take over you. You're letting your desires take over you. You're letting your temper take over you. You're letting your emotions take over. But it's not your mind functioning. If your mind is functioning, you'd say, hold on, this is not the right thing to do. I got to stop. Because the intellect will do God's will because the intellect knows that God's will is what has to be done. And there's no reason to go against God. It doesn't make any sense to go against God. So because our sins come from this concept of shtus, of being foolish, shtus, being being foolish, being a little bit crazy at times, therefore the wood used to build the altar has a reference to this concept of foolishness. The wood is atzei shittim wood. It's the same letters as shtus, the same letters. So that's a type of cedar wood, but the name itself alludes to the idea of shtus, of foolishness, of craziness. Many, many times throughout the Tanakh, people who are wicked are referred to as fools. We say they're evil, they're horrible, they're disgusting. So the Torah calls them fools all that very often, because they're foolish. What they're doing makes no sense at all. So we refer to them as kesilim, as hasiya, many different words in Hebrew used for foolishness. But they're referred to as fools, because sinning is not just evil, but it's foolish. It's not rational. It doesn't make sense. So the wicked in the Torah are referred to as fools. If we were thinking straight, we wouldn't do it. That's also why the Kli Yakar writes the altar was made out of hollow. It was hollow in the middle. The Torah says clearly it has to be hollow. Nevuv luchos, hollow wood, hollow boards. Why is it hollow? It's very strange that it has to be hollow in the middle. Usually they would say, let's make it very, very, you know, strong. Let's reinforce it. Let's make it so it's going to be this the very heavy, strong piece of furniture. We say it should be hollow. Because somebody who sins, they're hollow on the inside, meaning that they're not thinking. Their brain isn't functioning at the time. You know, we say that somebody is called empty-headed. Not a nice term to say, but the person is acting empty-headed temporarily when they sin. So the person has become hollow, and therefore the hollow altar is going to atone for them. That's the idea of this hollow, that the fact that it's hollow. The vuv luchos, hollow in the middle. The verse says in the book of Iov, the book of Job, it says, Ish nevuv yila bev. A person who is hollow should attain an understanding heart. It's the way that the commentaries explain it. So a hollow person is someone who doesn't have understanding. He doesn't understand. He doesn't know. Doesn't have wisdom. That hollow person, just like the hollow altar, should attain a heart of understanding. So we see the concept of being hollow is used many times throughout the Tanakh as meaning someone who doesn't understand, doesn't know, is not using their mind. So therefore, the hollow mizbeach, the hollow altar, is going to atone for us, ourselves being hollow, because we've been hollow at times. There's another very interesting point, which is that it has to be square. We talk about the dimensions. The dimensions, we said, were five amos wide, five amos long, and 10 amos high. The rabbis tell us that these dimensions, they are not necessary to keep the same dimensions. You can make an altar a different size if you want to, but it has to be square. It is a deal breaker. If the altar is not square, it's not a valid altar. You can't use it for sacrificial service. It has to be square. So why is it square? It's a very strange thing. Why is it such an important, an essential part of the altar that it should be square? And the truth is, you find many, many places halachically that require squares. Such as tefillin have to be square. The ark wasn't square, it was rectangular, but the idea of rectangulars or squares are very common in halacha. You don't find halacha mandating circles anywhere. It's very hard to find a place where halacha mandates it must be circular. Yeah. Chala, that's a custom. It's not mandated. That's something. It's a good thought. It's a good thought. Yeah. But nowhere does the halacha require circle. The halacha requires squares. So that's the concept of things being square. So it's pointed out in the Jerusalem Talmud that there's nothing natural which grows square. I was thinking about it. I mean, this is like an example. But the Gemara says that there's nothing which is natural that grows square. Everything natural grows rounded, circular, but you don't find anything in the natural world which is a square. I see everyone's thinking, is there something out there? I couldn't think of anything. But nothing natural grows square. So Rav Hirsch, Rav Yishevah Hirsch explains, oh thank you, Rav Hirsch explains, thank you, Rav Hirsch explains that some things made of angles, things made of squares, that means that there has been human involvement. Things which are circular, nature grows round, meaning that things start from a center point and they equally grow in all directions, so things end up being round. But when it comes to human beings, humans intervene, and we're able to carve out angles, to carve out squares and rectangles. That's what we do. But natural world, you don't find anything which is rectangular or square. Everything natural world is going to be rounded in some way. And the only time you find it even not growing round is when things kind of like get in its way and block it. Usually things grow pretty much, you know, trees grow around, things grow rounded or circular out in nature. So the altar, along with many other mitzvah objects, has to be square. And we could say that that symbolizes the fact that the altar is here for human beings who, with their human free choice and their human intellect, have their human challenges. And therefore, this is to atone for us human beings who are not perfect and need atonement. If we were like nature, we would be round. We would not do anything wrong. Trees don't sin. You know, God told the trees, this is how you grow, and the trees grow. God told gravity, you're going to work, and gravity works. You know, God told, I mean, anything which is scientific, we believe that science is also a command of God. God commanded the world, this is how you should function. That's how we understand it. God told that any scientific equation, any scientific law, it's because God commanded that law should be, and the world listens to God. So when God tells the trees, you grow this way, when God tells the ocean, you function this way, when God tells gravity, you go this way, when God tells chemicals, this is how you're going to react, they do it every single time. That's what science means. You can test it over and over again. You always get the same exact result because that's why it's scientific. Why is that? Because nature has no free choice. Nature has no yitzhara. Nature just does as it's told. The human being, we should be like nature. We should listen to God exactly. But God gave us free choice. God gave us challenges. And therefore, at times, we don't listen to God. We're not robots like nature is. We're people. And therefore, we do have our challenges and don't always follow God. But that's represented by a square, because a square means that we have actually come into the world and intervened with a process in the natural world. So therefore, besides other mitzvah objects, the altar is going to be square because it represents the very human element of life. That's why God mandates tefillin should be square. And anything which is a shape is mandated in halacha, typically it's going to be a square or a rectangular shape. You're not going to find a circle mandated in halacha anywhere. So it's a very interesting concept when you think about it. When I read that, I was like, wow, that's, you know, but it's when you think about it, there's nothing in nature which is square. It's a very interesting thing. So that's the symbolism of the square altar. Square altar is a symbol of being human. That's what the square means. The altar has to be square no matter what. It could be larger, it could be small, but it has to be square. Yeah.
You're saying it represents human. Could you say it represents free will and leave out the word human?
Yeah, I think that works. Animals, I guess, can make things that are square as well. I mean, animals can go and square out things, but things don't grow naturally square. I think that's, yeah. Okay. It represents the free will that it represents. Because we have free will, square represents free will. It's not just, doesn't just grow out like a robot, like nature does. And therefore, free will is what leads us to sin, which leads us to the altar for atonement. So therefore, the altar has to be square. That's a good way to put it. So that's the shape of the altar. That's the material of wood. Oh, I forgot to talk about the other material, copper. Right? The altar is plated with copper. Now, till now, we've discussed only golden vessels. Inside the actual temple sanctuary in the Holy of Holies, there's a golden altar. There was a golden menorah. There was a golden table. There was a golden incense altar. The outer altar that we're discussing was made with copper. Copper is by no means as precious as gold. It's not, you know, it's not as valued as gold. It's a very different material. So what does copper represent to us? It's very interesting because halakhically, in the Mishkan, so God says you should collect for yourself to build the Mishkan gold, silver, and copper. So gold and silver are these precious metals which are very valuable, which everyone appreciates, and copper seems to just be, you know, kind of a standard metal. I don't know where it ranks in terms of like iron or steel, but it's not when we look at it as a precious metal, copper. So what's the concept of copper? The other interesting point about copper is that the word in Hebrew for copper is nechoshes. And it has the same root word as nachash, which is a snake. And we all know what the snake represents in Judaism. We know the snake was the original form of evil which came to entice Adam and Chava to eat from the tree. So copper is related in Hebrew, nachash and nechoshes, the same letters, the noin, neches, and the shin. So how do we view this? Also, very often you find the metaphor in the Torah for somebody who's kind of like stubborn or somebody who is, you know, audacious as being, he's called a mitzach nechush, he has a copper forehead. That's the wording used. He has a forehead of copper. He won't budge. You know, we can't get him to move. It's a wording used throughout the Tanakh and also used by the rabbis. Your mitzvah, you have this copper forehead. So copper is looked at as a very tough metal. It's a metal used in the Mishkan. Now gold is, I think it's a little softer metal. Copper is a very tough metal. So what's the idea of copper? So if we think about it, copper, if we look at the original snake was the first one to propose the concept of sin to the world. The original snake enticed Adam and Eve to sin, and he was the original one who had the nerve to go up against God. He said, I'm not doing what God wants, I do what I want. I'm going to follow what I'd like to do, regardless of God's command. That's what the original snake said. And I'm going to make sure the human beings follow my lead. And I'm going to go and convince them to eat from this tree. That's the original snake. So understand how the original snake's attitude can be translated into that person with the copper forehead. That person who is very stubborn. Person who has chutzpah. You know, I don't care what God says. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to follow my own ways, regardless of anyone else's commands. So this representative of copper represents to us a very firm metal, a metal which is not precious. It's not a beautiful metal. It's just a very firm, tough metal, which represents being stubborn, represents having the nerve to go up against authority, having the nerve to shirk off God's law. That's what copper represents. So just like you have the nachash, the snake, you have nechoshes, you have copper. So again, it's very apropos for the altar, which is here for our atonement, representing our sins, that the material used is copper. Because part of what causes one to sin is that attitude that I like to do what I want to do. I don't like having to be subject to authority. I don't like having to submit myself to anything greater. I want to do it my own way. Following God's law means you have to submit yourself. Sometimes you don't want to do it. You have to do it anyways because it's what God said to do. But somebody has that copper forehead, somebody who has this stubborn attitude, this nerve to go up against the authority of God and to remain in their own world and do what they want to do, regardless of God's word, is represented by copper. Copper represents that. So the idea of having copper on the altar, that's representative to us of this attitude of a person who sins, that I'm going to do what I want to do no matter what. Not every sin comes from that attitude, but many sins do come from that attitude. So you have a question? Yeah. He was cursed in the Torah.
What?
The Torah, he's cursed. God says, you're going to be the most cursed of all animals. You have to slither on your stomach. You're going to fight the human being. So eat the dust of the earth. Yeah, so he does get a curse in the Torah. So he is up for punishment, it seems.
Here's another question.
Yeah.
How do you say that with the snake in Hebrew?
Nachash. Nachash.
And also, the copper that I showed, does that have anything to do with the women with the copper mirrors in Egypt?
It was actually used for something else. So we'll talk about that, I think, next week, copper mirrors. But yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Where they have it from? It seems they had it when the Egyptians all drowned in the sea, they had with them all their golden chariots. And the Jews collected all the jewelry and all the gold from all the chariots. That seems where they got the gold from.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Plunder, it's an uncertain word. When they left Egypt, the Egyptians gave them treasure.
That's also true, right? Yeah, that's also true, right? They were given treasures as they left Egypt, right? It says that they went to all their neighbors and asked them for all their treasures, and they gave them all their treasures. That's also that's one source of their metals, yeah.
I remember, I'm not sure, but each Jew had 70 donkeys to carry.
Right. When they took from Egypt, they got to take a lot of stuff. So, fine. So that's the idea of copper. So copper is a metal that represents being very firm. It has negative connotation of being stubborn in a negative way. I mean, sometimes stubborn is good. Being stubborn in your ways when you're doing the right thing is a good thing. If you're doing the right thing and everyone's trying to convince you otherwise, so you should be stubborn. I'm doing what I want to do. This is the right thing to do. But when you're being stubborn in the wrong ways and you're not submitting to that which is right, that's negative. That's a problem. And that's so copper represents the stubbornness of the snake to submit to God, the nachash and the choshes. That connection is found in the copper. It's very appropriate that the altar, which is there for atonement, is made out of copper. I'd like to then discuss the michbar. We discussed there was this meshwork going around the altar. So there was this amma, it was 2 feet tall, of like a copper meshwork encircling the entire altar. Why do you have a meshwork there? Why is it? It's like a netting. That's the point of that. So the simple understanding is it's for beauty, it's to make it look nice. That's very strange. Why is there a net on the altar? So the Kliyakar points out that the net represents the net which is cast for us by the Yetzer Hara. Our drive towards evil, the Yetzer Hara in the world, which tries to pull us to do the wrong thing, he tries to trap us. Right? We understand the concept of the Yetzer Hara, in short, is that God created within every single person a challenge. Because if we aren't given a challenge, we're not going to have free choice. If we're told, okay, this is the Torah, do it, and there's nothing pulling us away from the Torah, so of course we're going to do it. We're going to end up being just like nature. We're going to be robots. So God says, I'm creating within you a challenge. We call it the Yetzer Hara. And there's part of you which is always going to pull you away from doing the right thing. It's going to bring you into bad traits. It's going to cause you to sin. It's going to pull you away from God, pull you away from good. And it's going to create that challenge in a person. And your job in this world is to overcome that challenge. That's the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara, metaphorically, so he's always casting a net to trap us. And the rabbis tell us, the Yetzer Hara in a person, it develops, it becomes more sophisticated and more advanced as you become older, as you grow, as you mature. So it also becomes more sophisticated and more mature. So even the greatest scholars and the greatest sages and the great, most righteous people in the world, the rabbis tell us they have a much more intricate and complicated Yetzer Hara. It says, Kol ha, the greater you are, the greater your Yetzer Hara is. That's what they're at. The greater Yetzer Hara is within you. So a simple person has a simple Yetzer Hara. See, you take a very lowly person. So he's being challenged, should I murder or not murder today? Right? And that's his challenge. For us, you know, thank God that's not a challenge we have. I'm not waking up in the morning, okay, am I going to murder someone today or not? So our playing field keeps moving. So the playing field is no longer murder. So then it comes to stealing. Then it comes to adultery. Then it comes to anger. Then it comes to, you know, one detail of a small technicality in the laws of Shabbos. I mean, the more that you advance, the greater challenge, the challenges you have are much more intricate, much more complex. So there's always that net being cast for a person. Yeah.
The more you advance in as a Jew, or the more you advance in life? My thought was,
I think it's both.
Because my thought was my question was, the more you advance as a Jew, or the more you advance in life? Because I was thinking of Bernie Madoff when you said that. It's easier to sin when you're not going to get caught, so you're far more challenged.
Right. And it's both true.
I mean,
both a person from their own advancement as a person and their own maturity, they're going to have different challenges. I mean, a 10-year-old kid has greater challenges in life than an adult. That's clear. But Jewish or not, you know, observant or not, it's greater challenges. But then as you advance as a Jew also, your challenges as a Jew become more intricate. You know, no longer is eating the pork chop the challenge. The challenge might be, you know, maybe this, you know, what, the thing that fell in my pot wasn't the right thing I put in. Maybe, you know, the things get more as you move along, but the pork chop doesn't speak to you as a challenge anymore. You know, and people feel it. As you grow as a Jew, you understand your challenges have changed. And the old challenges, which actually were challenges and we had to fight, we don't fight those challenges. We passed them. We're victorious. We've moved on to the next level of our playing field. That's how we have to view the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is always casting a net for us. And that net, she's trapping us. And that trap, if we get by one trap, there's another trap being cast for us. You get by that one, another trap. It never ends, because that's what it means to be a human being. A human being has to have a challenge. And the greatest Jew, the greatest sage, the most righteous and holy Jew in the whole world, his challenges are going to be extremely sophisticated and intricate and much more complex than ours. But he also has challenges as well. You know, the Gaon of Vilna, who spent 22 hours a day studying Torah, he only slept 2 hours a day. He was, you know, almost, he was angelic almost every way. He had challenges also. And he had his own challenges, which are on a level far beyond our challenges. He also had challenges, because he's a human being, and human beings have free choice and have challenges. So the Yetzer Hara's traps just became more intricate and more sophisticated traps. The traps are always there. And it's always there trying to get us, to ambush us, because that's what creates the challenge in life. If we didn't have that, then we'd be robots. And we don't want to be robots. We want to be people. You know, being a robot, robots can't accomplish, robots don't get rewarded, robots get nothing, they're robots. We're people, because we have a challenge, that's why we get a reward, that's what we can accomplish. So the Yetzer Hara is always there, casting his nets out for us, and as we pass by one net, we get to the next net. So you have on the altar a net, and that net represents why the person sinned. You have here, this is the closer. It's like a meshwork going around. Like Rashi says, it's like a net. That's Rashi calls it a net. Because we get ensnared by the net of the Yetzer Hara constantly. And what brings us to sin is that net, that trap.
Is that the net?
Yeah, below the designs. You have that. Yeah, below the design.
What is this?
That's a ramp. That's separate. It's the ramp. Below the design is that net, that meshwork.
Okay.
So that's the concept of the traps of the Yetzer Hara, which are set for us. Therefore, on the altar of atonement, there's a trap. There's a net waiting to catch us. So that brings us to, we're running out of time here, just two more quick points. We have on top the horns coming out. There's different protrusions on the top corners are called karnos, they're called horns. A karen in Hebrew is a horn. What's the concept of a horn? So the Kuyakar writes that a sinner is also referred to as somebody who gores towards God. I mean, just like you have a goring ox, he takes his horns and he tries to, you know, gore a person. So a sinner is attacking God, in a sense. Somebody who sins, he has now taken his horns and tried to attack God. I mean, the sinner doesn't realize how destructive sin can be. Sin is destructive on so many levels. It's destructive and dangerous. Very often, on a very practical human level, it's destructive to relationships. It's destructive in more spiritual, you know, Kabbalistic realms. But it's destructive in many, many ways. We have to look at it as a dangerous, goring ox. And we sin, and we're like that ox running around with his horns going crazy. We're like the bull set free and running through the crowds. That's what we're like when we sin. We don't always sense that. But a sinner is referred to by the rabbis as a goring ox. It says in the book of Psalms, it says, Al tarimu memareim karnechem. It's Lamar Karnachem. Do not lift up your horns to the heavens. Meaning that a sinner takes his horns and starts goring the heavens. And we shouldn't do that. We have to make sure that we remain tame. And we don't endanger others, endanger the world. So sin is a destructive act, just like a goring ox, and therefore the altar which atones for sin has these horns coming out the four sides, representing that destructive nature of sin.
But it's not a protection.
No, everything we're talking about are things which cause person to sin. It's all representative of a sinner. So the copper, the netting, it's all representative of a sinner himself.
I'm picturing it more as protection for the Lord.
Right.
I thought the netting was to trap the evil choices. No?
Yeah, it's representative of the sinner's challenges and the sinner's. It's all about.
If it traps them, it protects them. No?
If it traps them, no, because it causes them to. If it traps them, it causes them to sin. I mean, Yitzhar traps us into sin. We're trying to escape those traps and remain free, and we get trapped by sin. That's what it's referring to.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Just for one final point, is that Rav Shimshon Pinkus, who we discussed before in this class, he points out a very interesting thing. He points out that the outer altar was used for animals. There was smoke, there was blood, guts, and gore on the outer altar. It was not a pleasant thing to look at. I mean, it was holy. It was miraculous. The pillar of smoke, the rabbis tell us, always went straight to the heavens, and even when it was very windy, the pillar of smoke never wavered, always went straight up. It was a miraculous and holy vessel, but it was blood, guts, and gore. That's what it was. It was animals, it was meat, it was blood, burning flesh. That's what it was. The inner altar, inside, we said it was for incense, and it was beautiful, it was gold, created a beautiful aroma. And the contrast is kind of striking. You have one altar, which is copper, it's bloody, it's smoky, it's smelly. You have an inner altar, which is very pleasant, very aromatic, very, very nice. You know, it's a very big contrast. So he says that symbolically, this represents two different types of people. You have a person, on the outer altar, people bring what we call them sacrifices. And people who view everything they do Jewishly as a sacrifice. It's very hard for me to be a Jew. It's very difficult. I do it anyways. It's a very special thing. But for that person sees it all as very difficult. You know, it's a hard job to be a Jew. It's difficult to be a Jew. But I do it because I have to do it. So that person who lives life as a Jew, everything's a sacrifice. Everything I'm giving up of myself, it's difficult for me, I'm doing it anyways. That's the person on the outside. But as the person advances, you move inside. And if you're the Jew who is on the inside, the Jew has the emotion and the love for the Judaism, so they don't look at it as sacrifice, they look at it as a beautiful, beautiful lifestyle. And that person smells the beautiful aroma of the incense. So you have that Jew who is the outer Jew, who everything is sacrifice, everything is hard, it's bloody, it's hard work, it's smoky, it's smelly. I do it because God said to do it, and I'm willing to devote myself and sacrifice my life for it. That's the Jew on the outside. But the Jew on the inside, represented by the golden altar for the incense, that person views life as beautiful. And it gives his Judaism has this beautiful smell, this beautiful aroma. It's like incense. It's gold. It's pleasant. It's not bloody. It's not guts and gore. So it's two types of Jews. And we feel both emotions at times. Sometimes we feel, this is so hard, but I'm doing this, I have to. Sometimes we feel that I love being Jewish. It's so beautiful. And you know, and I feel the beautiful aroma of my Judaism. We feel both at times. But you have two altars representing the service of a Jew, and you have the Jews who it's just hard and difficult, and it's the outer altar, you have the Jew who's the one of the inner altar who gets their heart involved and feels the beauty of Judaism. And you know, again, we feel both those at times. Both of them are part of the temple service, both are necessity. We have to do mitzvos, whether it's hard or easy, whether we like it or not, whether our hearts are into it or not, we still have to do God's will. But ultimately, we strive to be that Jew who's entered into the holy sanctuary, represented by the inner altar, who everything is pleasant. Judaism is everything easy for me. I love everything I do. I love the lifestyle, and it brings out that beautiful aroma in a person. So that's represented by these two different altars you had in the temple. Any questions?
Yeah.